We're on the back side of Miami Beach on the Biscayne Bay side on a beautiful day. And it's an area that 5 years ago was flooding constantly.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. And all this week, we're live from WLRN in Miami, Florida. With the help of the Miami Foundation, we're reporting on a wide range of issues this week, from gun violence to gentrification and climate change. And that's what brought us to Miami Beach.
This area, they have raised everything you see here. They've raised the seawall. They've raised the roads. And the only thing they haven't raised are the larger buildings.
And that is?
Hal Wanless. I'm a professor in the Department of Geography and Regional Studies at the University of Miami.
Hal has been preaching about the dangers of sea level rise since the 1980s.
I started down in Miami doing a master's in 64, came back on the faculty in 71, and spent a lifetime trying to understand the past, present, and future of sea level rise.
We met up with Hal in Maurice Gibbs Park, which overlooks Biscayne Bay. Hal seemed perfectly comfortable in the sunny, humid, 90-degree heat. I, on the other hand, was about to melt. He brought us to this part of Miami Beach to give us a sort of climate change tour.
We're standing here in Maurice Gibbs Park on the bayside of Miami Beach. And as you look on to the west across Biscayne Bay, you can see the mainland with some of the high rises right along the shore. That area also was very low.
The first thing we noticed was that the edge of the park had literally been raised a few feet higher than the water. As we stood at the edge of the park, Hal tells me it wasn't always this way.
So this was an area that was flooding way too frequently. Because Miami's had about a foot of sea level rise in the last century, and because this was built by dredging up mud from the bay and putting it on top of mangroves that were flattened, and the mangroves decayed and the mud dewatered, and so this area had also settled some, but it was the rise of sea level, and as I said, we've had a foot since 1930 that got this to flooding.
So as we were coming over today, we were admiring a lot of the architecture, these beautiful pastel white buildings, noticing that there is even more construction happening.
We are building like there's no tomorrow.
But there, well, is there a tomorrow? I mean, that's the question.
For maybe the next 10 or 15 years, but sea level's accelerating dramatically now.
What is incentivizing people to build?
Because they can sell. It seems that people don't look more than 3 to 5 years when they're buying. They don't think that far ahead. But the problem is, we're sort of all along the Atlantic and Gulf Coast, and I guess all over the world, we're sort of into a real estate roulette world now, where you buy and hope you can sell before everybody says this is too inconvenient. You know, South Florida, even though the story is sort of dire, South Florida is just a beautiful place to live. The risk of increased damage from hurricane surges, the risk from the inconvenience and pollution from flooding, is as that increases, it will become a problem that will help people move on.
But I'm also thinking, we're standing here, it's a beautiful Sunday, the birds are chirping, the kids are playing, the joggers are out, and there's this impending sense of this could be over pretty soon.
I think many people have the ideas, because politicians don't like to face the reality, that, oh, they'll take care of it if it's a real problem. And you know, the problem with global warming is that we have been burning fossil fuels. We have elevated the atmospheric temperature by a degree above the pre-industrial levels. And the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says that 1 degree could be enough to trigger the whole melt of Greenland. The real problem that we face is that all this extra heat that's gone into the atmosphere because of burning fossil fuels, 93%+ of that has transferred to the ocean. And the warming is transferring. Most of it's in the upper 1,000 meters, but it's also getting deeper, and that both expands the ocean, and it's getting in around the outlet fjords of Greenland and Antarctica and going in under the ice and accelerating ice melt. That's unfathomable how you could stop that. That could be 2 more feet by 20, 46, which if you're looking right here, that puts, even though they raised this park we're at, this puts this back underwater.
With parts of Miami flooding regularly and sea levels rising, residents in the area are basically being displaced. Later this week, we're going to talk about how climate change is fueling gentrification.
Yeah, well, I think all you have to do is talk to one of the major developers behind developing Little Haiti when he said this is beachfront property in a few years. And so, as with most people of wealthy means, they think they can move about wherever they want. And they've decided that Liberty City, Little Haiti, Alapata are all neighborhoods that are on the rise for them. As they know that climate change is going to happen, this city was built in a part of the world that is going to be afflicted by what we've done to the environment. And so they're building, they're buying up property in Liberty City, which is a black neighborhood. It's been a black neighborhood for almost a century. And they're saying, hey, this is the highest point in the city. It's built on sturdy ground. And so we're going to take it.
That's Philip Agnew. He's the co-director of Dream Defenders, a social justice organization here in Florida. And we caught up with him at a community event in Liberty City, Miami. More on how climate change is shaping the gentrification in Miami and what people are doing about it this week on The Takeaway, live from WLRN in South Florida. Think back to all those sci-fi movies and books that predict what the future will look like with climate change. Being here in Miami, it really does seem like the future might already be here.
You think about 6 inches of water, basically permanent, around our communities down here. And that's potentially within the next 15 years. So that's sort of what we're looking at as far as the urgency.
That's Kate Stein, an environment reporter for WLRN here in Miami. And Kate says that folks are already facing some of the threats and consequences from climate change.
Hurricane season technically started June 1st, so just a few days ago. And we had a subtropical storm, Alberto, just right before hurricane season even technically started. We've had really heavy rainfall over the past couple of weeks, which, yes, Florida usually has a wet season, but this year it seems to be earlier. We also have things like king tide flooding and sunny day flooding, where the skies will be perfectly blue, but just because of the sea level rise combined with the regular, you know, high tide, that leads to flooding, you know, water coming up through storm drains and in the streets, and people are driving their cars through 6 or 8 inches of water some days. And of course, it gets worse if there's a lot of rain. We have, remember the Zika outbreak in 2016? Well, there's some evidence that because of a changing climate and because of global warming, mosquitoes are actually able to live longer farther north. And so potentially things like mosquito-borne illnesses are also a consequence of climate change that we are seeing in South Florida. And then there's the heat, too. Sorry, one more thing.
No, please.
The heat. You know, global warming, that means temperatures are rising. And so for people who are elderly and don't have air conditioning, it's hard on them. Or people who are low income. Or for people who are agricultural workers, you know, South Florida is a big agricultural area. They are going to be impacted and are already starting to be impacted by global warming and climate change.
And what about FEMA and federal flood insurance programs here on the
right
ground?
So that's a big deal here. We learned currently the National Flood Insurance Program and the federal government don't include sea level rise in their flood insurance cost models. That's huge, because as soon as sea level rise is included in those models, that means the insurance costs are going to go up for areas that are vulnerable to sea level rise, like South Florida. We learned just a couple of weeks ago at a conference here, a former FEMA administrator, Roy Wright, said that probably that change will happen in the next 2 to 3 years. And that has huge implications for South Florida's economy, because once the federal government begins including sea level rise in its insurance cost projections, that means insurance costs to homeowners and businesses will go up. But it also signals to the global markets that, hey, the federal government here is looking at sea level rise as a threat to South Florida. And so investors and banks, and we're an economy that's very dependent on foreign investment in real estate, all those people are going to look at this change to the National Flood Insurance Program and say, oh, hey, they're including sea level rise in their insurance projections. Maybe South Florida is actually a pretty risky place to invest. And so that makes sea level rise and the risk of sea level rise, it's almost like the risk is going to sink us before the seas ever do if you know, governments aren't able to step up here and really show that they're able to take action and put into effect some adaptations and, you know, do some of the different things that they are potentially able to do to protect our infrastructure and real estate and property down here.
And it's interesting, Miami is similar to New York in that it's had a ton of foreign investment, particularly when it comes to housing. Has there been a tapering off of that investment?
Really, there has not. Actually, there was a report on NPR not that long ago about how foreign investors are continuing to come to Miami and continuing to buy up property. And even if you just look outside the windows of our office, you can see there are all these cranes in downtown Miami. So no, it doesn't feel right now like there's a lot of tapering of foreign investment. But we've also had insurance companies and insurance risk modeling companies come in and say, hey, we're starting to look at this. And we know that credit ratings agencies are looking at sea level rise and its potential impact on South Florida as well. So there's a fear that it's just a question of, you know, once insurers and once bond rating agencies really start factoring in sea level rise to their assessment of South Florida's risk, then that they'll, you know, start signaling to foreign investors and to banks that this is maybe not the safest place to invest. And so that's why it feels so imperative right now for local leaders to really be able to point to adaptation projects and be able to say, yes, we have this risk from sea level rise, but here are the things that we're doing about it.
And is there a sense of worry in the communities here in Miami, the residents who've been here for a long time?
That totally depends on who you ask. I think that, interestingly, I mean, obviously, so the developers and architects, they're worried about the implications for property. Some of them are. Some of them are not yet. You know, city officials, county officials, planners, urban planners, they're worried about what this would mean for our infrastructure. And then there's this growing sense of concern that climate change and sea level rise are really issues of injustice in lower income communities and communities that are historically of color. And one reason for that is because in the past, you know, people who had money wanted to be by the water. And so there's a sense that climate gentrification is taking place. And what that means is that the people who are in these lower income communities on higher ground feel like they're being forced out, and in some cases are being priced out of their homes because people on the coasts are starting to want to look inland and move inland. And so in that community, there's been a growing sense of urgency. But I think still, if you walked up to a lot of people on the street and asked them to talk about sea level rise and what it means for them, it would be a pretty foreign concept.
And we're going to be talking a lot about these issues and more while we're here in Miami this week. Kate, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, Tanzina.
Kate Stein is an environment reporter here at WLRN in Miami.
Shine a light and whoa, we will be something special. Whoa, we will shine.
Yesterday, hundreds of students graduated at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. It was an emotional day, with four seats left empty for the seniors who were killed just over 3 months ago after a gunman shot 17 people to death. In the weeks following the shooting, WLRN asked Leonor Munoz, a senior at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, to record her thoughts in an audio diary. We'd like to share with you some of Munoz's thoughts as she struggled to cope and to make it to graduation day. Here's a dispatch from Munoz, a little over a month after the shooting. Wednesday, March 21st, 2018.
I woke up last night, in the middle of the night, with the weirdest feeling. Like, I couldn't move. I don't know, sleep paralysis or whatever. I was so dizzy. It was like the dizziness was in my arms. And I don't know, just kind of accepted and went back to sleep because at that point, like this is the least of my problems. I want to protect all my friends. I can't stop bullets midair. I can't stop depression. I can't stop PTSD. I'm just so scared.
Thursday, March 22nd.
I knew Carmen Shenshup since middle school. I wasn't amazing friends with her, but I've been parties with her. We had a couple group projects together. She was supposed to be the person who, like, graduated from UF, went to Harvard Med, became a cardiologist and a neuroscientist all at once, found the cure to cancer, all of that. And out of all the people I've cried for, I haven't cried for her because it doesn't feel real. She should still be in my class. She should still be here.
Friday, March 23rd.
I don't know if this is something that my underdeveloped teenage brain would normally be feeling this, or if it's because I went through something traumatic and the slightest thing can just send me to, like, extreme stress mode. Something banging, like a door closing, a door opening, knocking, a pop. My family and I, we went to go eat. It probably wasn't a good idea to go to a lobster place because you have to crack the lobster. And I couldn't exactly tell my parents, like, hey, don't eat the lobster that you just paid a lot of money for.
We are here united until no child ever lives with the fear of a bullet. Not one more!
On Saturday, March 24th, Leonore and her sister spoke before tens of thousands of people at a March for Our Lives rally in Boston.
Today is Sunday, March 25th. The day after the march. I looked at a picture later and we shut down Boston. Like, just shut it down. There are so many people. It makes sense because we're not marching against the Second Amendment. We're marching for our lives. That's what we are marching for. Not dying. My favorite thing that we sang, it was a marching song. It started off, "Justice, my friend, you will not walk alone. We will walk with you and make your spirit strong." And we would replace saying justice with Parkland, my friend. Newtown, my friend. Columbine, my friend. A lot of the march, we were recognizing that we were building off of other movements, the Black Lives Matter movement, the Civil Rights movement, the If Not Now movement. Gun violence did not start February 14th, 2018. We knew we were making history.
Now, it's Friday, May 4th, a month before graduation. Leonore is sitting in Marjorie's garden outside of her school. She says it's a peaceful place to be.
Yesterday, I started crying, and my friend texts me. She's like, hey, I miss her. We both kind of knew who we were talking about. She was friends with Gina Montalto. I was like, yeah, I feel that a lot. And just, it was awful, it was heartbreaking, but it was really nice just talking about our friends.
On Sunday, Leonore Munoz graduated from Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. Sammy Mack is a reporter for WLRN News who worked closely with Leonore on those audio diaries. Sammy, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Those were heavy and emotional words from Leonore. How have she and her classmates coped in the weeks and months since the shooting?
It's been really hard. At one point, she said that they're suffering, but they're doing it together. And I think for her and for a lot of the kids that we've heard from, the sort of force field of teenage friendship has been really, really important to them.
Now, the last time you spoke to Leonore was before the graduation. Tell us a little bit about how she was feeling and what she was planning on doing.
She was really excited for graduation. She was getting her mortarboard ready to write on the top of her hat. She wanted them to finally say her name correctly because apparently it gets mispronounced all the time. But she also said something that I've actually heard before. We've done a lot of reporting around kids who survive shootings. And she said that she would be carrying Carmen Shentrop with her. And when I talked to her, she was getting ready to go to the salon to get her hair prepped to dye a streak teal. Teal was Carmen's favorite color. And so that was her way of helping carry Carmen across the stage.
Just listening to her audio diary, I'm wondering, and we've seen the kids on television, their level of awareness is very high, but their emotional awareness also seems really high. They're sort of clear on PTSD. Did you pick that up from a lot of the students?
I mean, those are the students that we're hearing from. Those are the students who are in a place where they can talk. And you hear in the audio diary that Lenore is in therapy. She has a family that is really, really supportive. She is in a place where, as much as she is hurting, she can tell this story. But I think there are a lot of folks that we're not hearing from who are not processing this the same way. And then, you know, not everybody is going to come out of this with the same kind of trauma, the same reaction to trauma. Trauma is a really difficult thing to predict. And it's hard to see it coming, and it's hard to predict who's going to have a hard time dealing with it and processing it, and who's going to need more help than other folks.
And what's next for Lenore?
She goes off to college in the fall. She wants to study communications. All of us here at the station are rooting for her. And I mean, the clips that you play are intimate and sad and angry, but she's also really funny. She's just kind of like a cool teenage kid, you know? So she's got a lot of things to look forward to.
Sammy Mack is a reporter for WLRN News who worked closely on this story. Sammy, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
We're not going to let you in. We're putting up a fight. You may have brought the dark, but together we will shine a light in. Whoa, we will be something special. Whoa.
Hey, podcast listeners, remember, we need your help here at The Takeaway. We need you to tell your friends, your family, your enemies, anybody you know about this podcast. Tell them where they can subscribe. That's on iTunes, Pocket Casts, anywhere. Also, while you're there, give us a rating and review. It helps us out a ton. Thanks, and now back to the show.
Horror in Guatemala this weekend. The Fuego Volcano erupted. It was the most violent volcanic eruption for that country in more than a century, with red-hot rock and gas rushing down the mountainside and virtually swallowing up villages. Joining us now is Arturo Matute, an analyst for the International Crisis Group. Arturo, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Tell us about the Fuego Volcano.
Well, the Fuego Volcano is part of a chain of 32 volcanoes that cross from west to east all of Guatemala. And it's been active. You can always see it spewing a little bit of lava and sending out a bit of smoke. It's a sight to be seen by tourists, but it hadn't had this kind of activity in very, very many years. And it was really a huge explosion, totally unexpected.
Now, can you describe what the lava flows have been like? We're starting to see images of those, but what are you seeing there?
Right. We have been seeing that there's a canal of sorts that has been used to keep the lava that flows out of the volcano from overflowing into the adjacent communities. But yesterday's eruption was totally unexpected and not seen before in the levels that it came out. And it totally overflowed this canal that's used. And so the lava nobody could tell exactly in which direction it was going to flow. And unfortunately, it has gone into little villages and communities that live under the volcano and that harvest their crops there because of the richness of the soil. And it's still a situation that's not totally controlled. So we just saw the beginning of the rescue effort by the authorities during the afternoon and the night last night, but they had to stop their activities because of the darkness. But they've started right now since daybreak.
And the president has declared 3 days of national mourning. What will the process be like to rebuild these communities devastated by the eruption? I mean, I imagine we're just scratching the surface here.
Exactly, yes. This is just beginning. And unfortunately, the Guatemalan state does not have either the resources or enough technical capacities to set out a large rebuilding effort right away. Guatemala has very many problems with regards to housing, with regards to the provision of education and health services. So this is another hit for these communities close to the volcano. And if it starts soon, it will take a long time for rebuilding, for moving these huge quantities, amounts of lava that are now cooling off on the streets of different little towns around the volcano. So it will take a long time for sure.
Are there any expectations of another explosion or another, you know, similar to what we're seeing in Hawaii with Kilauea?
Right. Unfortunately, it's quite unpredictable. Volcanology, you cannot really tell when a volcano is going to erupt. And in the case of the Fuego volcano, it hadn't been as violently active as it is right now for almost a century. So the possibility is there that it can occur again. And as I was telling you before, there are 32 other volcanoes. Not all of them are active, but it could happen in other places as well. So the danger is there.
Arturo Matute is an analyst for the International Crisis Group. Arturo, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Big news today out of the Supreme Court, which ruled that a Colorado baker had the legal right to refuse to make a wedding cake for a gay couple back in 2012. Josh Gerstein is a senior reporter with Politico, and he was outside the Supreme Court. Josh, this ruling is a little more complicated than a win for the bakers, right?
Yeah, it definitely went in favor of the baker, who's a fellow by the name of Jack Phillips, and said that his rights to religious freedom had been violated. But this is not sort of the worst case scenario that some who are supporters of LGBT rights would have feared, because it really focused on the way this specific baker was treated in the process. He's from Colorado. Most of the proceedings involved an anti-discrimination commission there in Colorado. And a majority of the court, it looks like basically a 7-2 majority of the court. So a couple of the Democratic appointees, along with all the Republican ones, said that there was evidence of hostility to his religious beliefs. So it seems like it's a relatively narrow opinion that in this specific case, the commissioners did and said some things that made people think that this was based on hostility to Phillips' religion, but that if that wasn't a key issue or wasn't obvious, the issues would have to be dealt with separately. And the court didn't say where it would come down at that point.
So basically it's saying that the baker didn't get a fair process, right? Because they assumed some sort of bias against him by the Colorado Civil Rights Commission?
Well, they claim they have actual evidence of bias, that there were a couple comments made by commissioners at different points in the process. One commissioner said, compared it to slavery and the Holocaust, and said that those things had been defended on religious grounds, and that trying to defend discrimination on religious grounds was one of the most despicable things you could do. And Kennedy and the majority of the court seized on that, as well as the way some other bakers have been treated, and some of the facts specific to this case, like the fact that Colorado, when this happened in 2012, didn't actually recognize same-sex marriage.
So does that mean that there'll have to be another case brought to the Supreme Court by another type of business or another person that feels that they've been discriminated against in order to get to the heart of this issue?
I think there probably will be. I mean, one of the questions would be if some of these comments had not been made, if the commission simply said that's discrimination, you can't do it, you have to make the cake, and didn't try to opine on Phillips' religious beliefs and whether they were or weren't legitimate reasons for what he was doing, then this would have been a different case. And remember, a lot of the way these cases are going to come out, at least with the court set up the way it is right now, depends on Justice Kennedy. He is one of the biggest proponents of gay rights on the court, probably responsible almost single-handedly for the ruling legalizing gay marriage nationwide. So I don't think he's going to permit gay rights to really be eviscerated. But he also wrote the opinion here saying that the Baker's freedom of expression rights, and in this case, really freedom of religion rights, were violated. And I think that Kennedy is going to try to continue to police those lines, to assert that people can have their cake and eat it too, I guess, and that people's religious beliefs can be respected, and that people can also be treated fairly when they go into businesses. And some people would say the court basically punted on that issue today, leaving it to be resolved down the road.
So this really doesn't set a precedent, does it?
It sets a precedent, I think, only in very similar cases. You know, if you found another anti-discrimination panel that had made what were apparently or allegedly hostile comments about somebody's religion, if there were cases where you could show that somebody's in a similar situation got a different result, maybe in that situation it would be close enough to what happened with the Masterpiece Cake Shop that the Supreme Court opinion could be cited. But they actually say explicitly, we're leaving for down the road resolution of how these issues would be handled in different cases presenting different facts. I'm sure people will try to apply this case regardless of what side of the debate that they're on, but I don't think it gives them that much meat to hold on to.
So the issue of whether or not, say, someone goes into a cake shop or a flower shop or any type of shop today and says, I want to have something created for my same-sex marriage, and the person refuses, that's still up for debate. That has not been decided, correct?
It really hasn't been decided by the court. You see some people reacting to this on the gay rights side who are saying the sky is falling here, or the sky has fallen, and this is a serious blow. But many of the people who litigated the case say they're, you know, disappointed in the ruling. They don't think it should have come out this way. But the major issue of how to reconcile these rights in most of the cases you would come across hasn't really been squarely dealt with by the Supreme Court.
There was another ruling today by the Supreme Court for an undocumented teen to get an abortion. Can you tell us a little bit about that case?
So this is a case having to do with and stemming from a Trump administration policy that is basically to make it more difficult to resist, in virtually all cases, efforts by teens who are in immigration custody to get abortions. The Trump administration tried to block several teenage girls from getting abortions, and several of them ended up in court. In the particular case that ended up at the Supreme Court, it actually went to the highest appeals court in Washington, the D.C. Circuit, to their full bench, and they upheld the order saying that that girl was entitled to get an abortion. It wouldn't be paid for by the government, but the government essentially had to step out of the way, allow her to be taken for this abortion and returned to immigration custody. The issue ended up at the Supreme Court in kind of an awkward way, which was she actually got the abortion following that court order. And so there were questions about whether the order was moot, whether it would stand as a precedent for other cases, and also whether some of the lawyers that were working for this young woman, this teenage girl, had been honest with their counterparts in the Trump administration about what their plans were. And the court sort of set aside that issue about the candor of the attorneys and said that this dispute was really moot because the girl had received her abortion. So it's another instance where the court has essentially punted. It did erase that lower court precedent on this issue, but it didn't say what would happen the next time a situation like this arises. And given the Trump administration's policy, it's a near certainty that, you know, these kinds of situations will come up again, and that there are almost certainly girls in immigration custody right now who will be seeking an abortion over the Trump administration's objections.
Josh Gerstein is a senior reporter for Politico. Josh, thanks for being with us.
Okay, Tanzina, anytime.
And we want to thank you so much for listening to us today. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway, or if you're so inclined, tweet me at Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway. We'll see you tomorrow.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.